Moving now to the opinions page for the Saturday, April 13th, Richmond Times-Dispatch, our first signed opinion piece comes from the Richmond Times-Dispatch's own Michael Paul Williams and is titled Old Community Hospital, Virginia Union University Needs to Build Trust. At a recent rally to preserve a black history site entrusted upon Virginia Union University, historian Selden Richardson used the school's own words as an argument against the demolition of Old Community Hospital. The first 10 words of the mission statement of Virginia Union University are these. Virginia Union University is nurtured by its African American heritage, he said during the rally at the hospital building on Overbrook Road. This seems cruelly ironic, as no imagination, no vision, no maintenance, and certainly no nurturing has been seen on this site in the 20 years Virginia Union has had it. To claim the high ground of African American heritage and let this case of demolition by neglect of an African American heritage site proceed is shameful. Virginia Union is partnering with New York-based Steinbridge Group to build up to 200 residences on acreage that includes the Old Richmond Community Hospital. The university and Steinbridge will be joint owners and share the profits in a redevelopment touted as a first step in the college's $500 million campus makeover. When Virginia Union announced the project in February, the hospital building was pronounced unsalvageable, setting off a community effort to save it. Since then, the university has struggled to alter the perception that it plans to demolish the building, but its attempts to shift the narrative have suffered from a lack of clarity and conviction. Virginia Union and Steinbridge sought to change this at an April 5th awards gala at the Greater Richmond Convention Center. Among the honorees were National Urban League President Mark Morial, Richmond Mayor LeVar Stoney, and Steinbridge founding partner and CEO Tawan Davis, who received Virginia Union's HBCU Impact Award for its investment in historically black colleges and universities like Virginia Union. During his speech, Davis said, "We are setting aside part of our commitment to honor the history, particularly the history of the Richmond Community Hospital at Virginia Union, with a $5.1 million commitment from our existing commitment to honor all those who were born and worked and built Virginia Union University and this hospital through its 160-year history." But again, the message was imprecise. Whose history is being honored? That of Virginia Union, which will celebrate its 160th anniversary next year? Or the hospital, whose roots date to 1902 in Jackson Ward and once bore the name of Dr. Sarah Garland Boyd Jones, a trailblazing black female physician. The Art Deco Community Hospital building was completed in 1932 after a painstaking fundraising effort by Richmond's black community during the Great Depression. For generations of black Richmonders, it was a beacon of welcome in a city whose white hospitals remained segregated until the late 1950s. Our city remains populated with people with memories of the hospital, including a future newspaper columnist who had his tonsils removed there as a child. Davis's speech also raised the question of what honor means in terms of the hospital building's preservation. "I don't think that is known yet," said Grant Neely, Virginia Union's vice president of community relations, on Wednesday. "What everybody's going to do is continue listening to the community, and we'll soon lay out our own process for community engagement." What does it mean? I can't say, because it's not known yet. But I would observe that $5.1 million buys a lot more than a nice plaque. Viola Baskerville, a leader of the Save Community Hospital effort, is skeptical. "I would question exactly what is meant by honoring the history," said Baskerville, a former member of the Richmond City Council and the Virginia House of Delegates, and a former state secretary of administration. "That is not the same thing as a commitment to make sure the building is not demolished, but is rehabilitated and adaptively reused as part of Virginia Union University's development plans," she said in an email. In addition, $5 million seems insufficient when looking at the scope of the present structure. She reiterated her call for Historic Richmond Foundation to independently assess the structure to inform future development. Historic Richmond Foundation is a known quantity to Virginia Union. It worked with the university on the restoration of Virginia Union's Industrial Hall, said Executive Director Cyan Crump. "We have offered," Crump said, "we would very much like to work with them to find preservation solutions that would save Richmond Community Hospital. We think it's a really important building that has a significant story to tell. It's clear to us that the community would like to see it saved." Historic Richmond Foundation would pull together volunteer architects, engineers, and construction experts to look at options to incorporate it into Virginia Union's larger plans, she said. That requires a cooperative effort with the property owners. As for Virginia Union, they've acknowledged receipt and more or less said they'd get back with us. Meanwhile, the debate surrounding the hospital has exposed fissures on the topic within the black community. Baskerville, in an April 8th email to State Senator Lamont Bagmy, Democrat of Richmond, said she was perplexed at the degree of silence exhibited by you as chair of the Legislative Black Caucus and many of your members towards the threat of demolition by Virginia Union University of the 1932 building that once housed Richmond Community Hospital on Richmond's north side. Bagmy replied that he was unaware of any active threats of demolition by Virginia Union University of the building and cited the $5 million set aside by Steinbridge. To which Baskerville replied, "No, there is not an active demolition permit on file with the city at this point, and I certainly hope you are not waiting for that to happen before you weigh in. However, the university has not published a statement clarifying that it in fact will not demolish the 1932 structure." She added, "Promises that funding will be set aside are one thing. Communicating a more concrete message to the community that the building will be saved and reused in the university's development plans is another." Friday evening, Neely issued Virginia Union's most concrete take yet on plans for the hospital. He said the development team on this project has expertise in historic preservation. The team and the university are committed to adaptive reuse of the Richmond Community Hospital building. This is expected to include at least the building's facade and likely more. Let's hope for likely more. Virginia Union can't build a sound future on a foundation of mistrust. And that was the opinion piece of Michael Paul Williams of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Old Community Hospital, Virginia Union University needs to build trust. Glenn?
Thank you, Steve. Next from the opinion page, A9 is... The juice was always on the run. O.J. Simpson, 1947 to 2024. And this is by Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post. When we picture scenes from the life of O.J. Simpson, we see him running away from pursuers, from justice, from his own demons. A compelling and tragic lifetime of flight came to an end Wednesday with Simpson's death from cancer at age 76. The juice is loose no more. On football fields, Simpson ran away from tacklers with breathtaking speed and agility. He first achieved fame as one of the greatest running backs in history. At the University of Southern California in 1968, he won the Heisman Trophy. Drafted by the NFL's Buffalo Bills, in 1973 he became the first player to rush for more than 2,000 yards in a single season. He was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. None of that fully captures the thrill of watching Simpson run. A linebacker would be bearing down on him inches away, and suddenly he would zigzag left or right, or both in succession, and he was gone. His running was charismatic. When you added the sparkle of his million-dollar smile and the polish of his perfect diction, he was irresistible. Everyone loved O.J. In his most famous TV commercial for Hertz Car Rental, he ran through airports just like he had run through defensive lines. Simpson made an instant transition from football star to Hollywood star. He was in The Towering Inferno. He was in the landmark Roots TV series. He played Detective Nordberg in three Naked Gun movies. He hosted Saturday Night Live. But then in 1994, he got into a white Ford Bronco and ran from the brutal, bloody killings of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. The ensuing low-speed chase on Los Angeles freeways was captured live by TV cameras and broadcast around the world. That night, I was watching the NBA Finals. When coverage of the game was interrupted for the breaking news of the Bronco chase, at first I was annoyed, then I was riveted. All of that was mere prelude, of course, to Simpson's greatest escape of all. As theater and as a legal circus, Simpson's murder trial has never been surpassed or even equaled. Its characters were vivid to the point of being indelible. Eager to please Judge Lance Ito, dutiful but overmatched prosecutors Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden, slick and razor-sharp defense lawyers Johnny L. Cochran Jr. and F. Lee Bailey, house guest Brian Cato Kalin, Simpson friend and counselor Robert Kardashian, progenitor of all things Kardashian, racist detective Mark Furman, in a non-speaking role, the Bloody Glove. Throughout his career as a football player, actor, and celebrity, Simpson had scrupulously avoided saying anything about issues involving race. He reportedly used to tell friends, "I'm not black, I'm O.J." Indeed, he was so beloved because he was seen as non-confrontational and non-threatening. Faced with the prospect of spending the rest of his life in prison, however, he embraced his blackness. His professed new racial consciousness allowed some black Americans, certainly not all, to at least consider the possibility that he was yet another black man being brutalized by a racist justice system. After all, the trial was taking place just 3 years after the Los Angeles riots, sparked when the police officers who savagely beat Rodney King were judged to have done nothing wrong. The evidence against Simpson was overwhelming, even though the murder weapon, a knife, was never found. The trial took 11 months. The jury took less than 4 hours to reach its shocking verdict, not guilty. I have not a scintilla of doubt that he committed the murders. In 2007, Simpson even had the gall to write a book, If I Did It, which he said was a hypothetical narrative of how he would have committed the crime, wink, but of course he didn't. He often blathered on about how police should be looking for the real killer who was supposedly still out there somewhere. In 2008, Simpson was convicted in Las Vegas of armed robbery and other charges, connected with what he claimed was an attempt to recover some stolen sports memorabilia, and given a harsh 33-year prison sentence, which struck me as akin to a referee's makeup call correcting a previous error. But he was released on parole in 2017, and he spent the rest of his healthy years playing golf. It was a diminished life, to be sure. He had just a fraction of his one-time wealth and status. His celebrity was of the most tarnished kind. His need for adulation would never again be requited. He was a pariah. But O.J. Simpson died a free man. He zigged and zagged all his life and never quite got caught. And again, from the opinions page A9, that was The Juice Was Always on the Run, O.J. Simpson, 1947 to 2024, by Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post. Steve?
Thank you, Glenn. And concluding the opinions page, we have one letter today. This is the correspondent of the week, Becca Amos of Richmond. And her letter is titled, Use of Canines in Prisons is Torture. Dogs have been used to patrol, intimidate, and attack incarcerated individuals in Virginia more than any other state. 271 cases, a wildly disproportionate rate, were documented between 2017 and 2022. Arizona, the second highest rate, had 15 cases. No other country in the world uses canines as force in their prisons and jails. Delegate Holly Siebold, Democrat of Fairfax, made a valiant effort to eliminate the use of canines in correctional facilities, full stop, with the exception of detection, when she introduced House Bill 159 in the 2024 General Assembly. However, Delegate Michael Wiebert, Republican of Fauquier, chief co-patron of this bill, introduced exceptions that were added to House Bill 159, including the approved use of canines for when officers find it is necessary to prevent serious injury or death, and if prior approval is granted from superiors to intervene during an altercation in which more than two prisoners are involved. Countless testimonies and studies prove the use of canines in correctional facilities leaves victims with permanent psychological and physical trauma. The practice egregiously upholds discriminatory tactics used to control and intimidate black individuals throughout Virginia's history of enslavement. It perpetuates the racial power dynamics and systems of punishment in the city of Richmond itself. The exceptions allow further unchecked torture and intimidation, amounting to violations of the Eighth Amendment, constituting cruel and unusual punishment. From Jim Crow to redlining to canine use of force, new iterations of oppressive policy pass and take root. As a social worker, a teacher in correctional facilities, therapist, and doula in this city I love, I cannot stay quiet on the issue. This is a call to action for anyone who knows that while the past cannot be changed, the future can. All eyes on this bill, these practices, and the next General Assembly. And that was Becca Amos of Richmond, the correspondent of the week, and her letter was Use of Canines in Prisons is Torture. Glenn?
Thank you, Steve. We now move to page Y2 in the E edition of the Times-Dispatch, and this article is Errors of Engagement. Officials say strike that killed aid workers was a mistake. Critics say it was no anomaly. By Lee Keith of the Associated Press. Two basic mistakes, according to the Israeli military. First, officers overlooked a message detailing the vehicles in the convoy. Second, a spotter saw someone boarding one car carrying something, possibly a bag, that he thought was a weapon. Officials say the result was the series of Israeli drone strikes that killed 7 aid workers on a dark Gaza road. The Israeli military described the deadly strike on the World Central Kitchen convoy as a tragic error. Its explanation raises the question, if that's the case, how often has Israel made such mistakes in its 6-month-old offensive in Gaza? Rights groups and aid workers say the mistake was hardly an anomaly. They say the wider problem is not violations of the military's rules of engagement, but the rules themselves. In Israel's drive to destroy Hamas after its October 7th attacks, the rights groups and aid workers say the military seems to have given itself wide leeway to determine what is a target and how many civilian deaths it allows as collateral damage. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's offensive, around two-thirds of them women and children, according to Gaza's health ministry. Its count doesn't distinguish between civilians and combatants. Israel says it is targeting Hamas fighters and infrastructure and that it tries to minimize civilian deaths. It blames the large number of civilian casualties on militants and says it's because they operate among the population. Israel says each strike goes through an assessment by legal experts, but it has not made its rules of engagement public. In the thousands of strikes Israel has carried out, as well as shelling and shooting and ground operations, it's impossible to know how many times a target has been wrongly identified. Nearly every day, strikes level buildings with Palestinian families inside, killing men, women, and children, with no explanation of the target or independent accountability over the proportionality of the strike. Sarit Makeli, spokeswoman for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, said the World Central Kitchen strike drew world attention only because foreigners were killed. The thought that this is a unique case, that it's a rare example, it's an insult to the intelligence of anyone who has been following the situation, she said. She said a broader investigation is needed into the rules of engagement. The relevant questions aren't asked because the investigations only deal with specific cases rather than the broader policy. Israel's chief military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, acknowledged mistakes were conducted in the last 6 months. We do everything we can not to harm innocent civilians, he told reporters. It is hard because Hamas is going with civilian clothes. Is it a problem? Is it complexity for us? Yes. Does that matter? No. We need to do more and more and more to distinguish. But the military hasn't specified how it will achieve this. Brigadier General Benny Gal, who was part of the investigation into the World Central Kitchen strikes, was asked whether more questions should be asked before a strike is authorized. This was not our standards, he said. The standard is more questions, more details, more crossing sources, and this was not the case. Palestinian witnesses have reportedly reported people, including women and children, being shot and killed or wounded by Israeli troops while carrying white flags. Several videos have surfaced showing Palestinians being fired at or killed while seeming to pose little threat to Israeli forces nearby. In March, the military acknowledged it shot dead 2 Palestinians and wounded a third while walking on a Gaza beach. It said troops opened fire after the men allegedly ignored warning shots. It reacted after the news channel Al Jazeera showed footage of one of the men falling to the ground while walking in an open area and then a bulldozer pushing 2 bodies into the garbage-strewn sand. It said at least 2 of the 3 men were waving white flags. Aid groups have also reported strikes on their personnel. Medical Aid for Palestine said its residential compound in the southern area of Muwasi, which the military had defined as a safe zone, was hit in January by what the UN determined was a 1,000-pound bomb. Several team members were injured in the building damage, the group said. The group said the Israeli military gave it multiple explanations, denying involvement, saying it was trying to hit a target nearby, and blaming a missile that went astray. The variety of responses highlights a continued lack of transparency, the group said. The medical charity, Doctors Without Borders, said a tank shelled a house sheltering its staff and their families in Mawasi in February, killing one staffer's wife and daughter-in-law. Both groups said they informed the military repeatedly of their relocations and clearly marked the buildings. Israeli admissions of mistakes are rare. In December, after a strike killed at least 106 people in the Maghazi camp, the military said buildings near the target were also hit, likely causing unintended harm to additional uninvolved civilians. It also admitted soldiers mistakenly shot to death three Israeli hostages who were waving white flags after getting out of Hamas captivity in Gaza City. In Israel's ground assaults, troops are operating in urban environments, searching for Hamas fighters while surrounded by a population hunkering in their homes and in motion, trying to flee or find food and medical care. Some Israeli politicians and news outlets regularly proclaim there are no innocents in Gaza. And in some videos circulated online, soldiers talk of getting revenge for the October 7th Hamas attacks that sparked the war. In that atmosphere, Palestinians and other critics say, soldiers on the ground appear to have wide liberty in deciding whether to target someone as suspicious. Residents and medical staff in Gaza say they see the result. Dr. Tanya Hajj Hassan, a doctor with medical aid for Palestinians, who just returned from 2 weeks at a Gaza hospital, said staff regularly treated children and elderly shot by snipers. It's not an anomaly, it's actually the pattern, she said. I don't think it's that children in particular are singled out as targets. The understanding and kind of the conclusion you reach is that everybody's a target. Chris Cobb-Smith, a former British Army and weapons expert who's done research and security missions in Gaza, said that if there was a breakdown in communication in the case of the World Central Kitchen strike, for a professional army, this is inexcusable. There seems to be a consistent pattern of utterly reckless behavior, said Cobb-Smith, who helped investigate the Doctors Without Borders shelling. Chris Lincoln-Jones, a former British intelligence staff officer who has worked in the defense industry, including alongside an Israeli drone manufacturer, said the investigation showed unprofessional actions and poor command and control. Even if a gunman had been in the car with aid personnel, he said, it wouldn't justify a strike unless the gunman was actually shooting at someone from the car. No way that a NATO drone pilot would do that. I would expect to be prosecuted for doing that. I would expect to face the possibility of prison. And again, that article from page Y2 was Errors of Engagement. Officials say strike that killed aid workers was a mistake. Critics say it was no anomaly. By Lee Keith of the Associated Press. Steve?
Thank you, Glenn. Next, from page A4, a local item, Siblings Charged in Lakeside Fire, by Samuel B. Parker of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Henrico County authorities announced Friday that two suspects had been arrested in a February 24th fire that badly damaged Carytown Burgers and Fries Lakeside. According to officials with the Henrico Division of Fire, Jordan Castaneda, 37, and Shelby Castaneda, 32, have been charged with burning or destroying a building or structure and conspiracy to commit a felony. The pair are siblings, officials said. Henrico fire crews were initially dispatched to the restaurant located at 5404 Lakeside Avenue at around 6:57 a.m. on February 24th for reports of a structure fire. At the scene, firefighters found a kitchen fire that had been partially suppressed by a water line. The fire was extinguished by 7:04 a.m., authorities said. The business was not open at the time and no injuries were reported, but Henrico assistant fire chief said the blaze caused significant damage to the business. The Castaneda's arrests came after weeks of examining evidence and conducting interviews, Rosenbaum said, which led investigators to believe the fire was intentionally set. The investigation is ongoing. Tiara Black, who owns Carytown Burgers and Fries Lakeside, did not respond to requests for comment. And that item from page A4 was Siblings Charged in Lakeside Fire, by Samuel B. Parker of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Glenn?
Thanks, Steve. Also from page A4, teacher accused of assaulting student. This is also by Samuel B. Parker of the Times-Dispatch. A Chesterfield County public schools teacher has been charged after police say she assaulted a student at J.G. Henning Elementary School on March 19th. Police say Alice McCollum, 60, on Thursday was served with a releasable warrant after detectives investigated the alleged assault against a female student of the school. McCollum has been charged with assault and battery, according to court records. She is next scheduled to appear in court on April 25th. She could not immediately be reached for comment. McCollum is at least the fifth CCPS employee to be charged in an altercation with a student since December. A teacher at Thomas Dale High School on December 5th was arrested and charged after police say he kicked a student in the leg in November. A Manchester High School teacher was charged on February 5th after allegedly striking a student at the school. A teacher at Spring Run Elementary School on March 12th was charged with assaulting a male student at the school. A teaching assistant at Meadowbrook High School on March 27th was arrested after police say she assaulted a male student. The teaching assistant, Trevana Kenyer, denied the charges. Chesterfield Public School spokesperson Sean Smith said McCollum will not return to the school division pending adjudication of the charges. He did not answer an inquiry as to whether there was a concerning pattern of assault at Chesterfield schools. And again from page A4, that was Teacher Accused of Assaulting Student by Samuel B. Parker of the Times-Dispatch.